The Connoisseur's Tongue. For several days, I've contemplated the next story and asked myself why I thought of such a thing. It is about a man, a gastronomist, who owns the tongue of the most famous food connoisseur of the 19th century, which the gastronome keeps immersed in formaldehyde in a bell jar on his mantle. A fire breaks out, and he doesn't dash for the family photos or the fireproof case of important financial documents in the family Bible. Instead, without even thinking twice, he reaches for his most prized possession, the connoisseur's large black tongue floating in a yellowish chemical gel. An ordinary-looking tongue, slightly large, but otherwise of normal dimensions. Once a precious symbol of cultural values preserved within the French Bureau of Gourmet Affairs, an institution dedicated to artifacts related to gourmet interests, maintained in its musty museum attic. The connoisseur's tongue was sold at a controversial private auction after World War II. Only two other collectors with gourmet obsessions. Former friends the gastronome had shared many dining adventures with in his explorations of world cuisines attended the exclusive auction. When the gastronome removed this French national treasure to the United States, traveling by train under the cloak of darkness, and then by ship across the Atlantic, he felt like a grave robber, but he was giddy with excitement he'd never felt before. While his train sped through the darkness, his good Italian friend, Anthony DiTillo, traveled to Perugia in a green Lamborghini race car with the connoisseur's stomach, and a German woman with whom he'd had relations in his youth, now disguised as an elderly gentleman, fled on a silver BMW motorcycle with the connoisseur's nose and throat. While many people have no difficulty understanding a museum that preserves the brains of Einstein, Walt Whitman, and Karl Marx, the great majority of people who hear of the food connoisseur's most precious organs parted out as trophies express shock and disgust, appalled that anyone would buy and live with a human tongue, a human stomach, or a human nose and throat. On the day of the fire, though, when the gastronome in question left behind a Dachshund, a Rex kitten, and a Brazilian parrot, along with his family's most important documents, in favor of reaching for the connoisseur's tongue, questions of good taste became paramount among the gourmets of the 21st century. Opinion was equally divided between those who understood and those who drew a line in the proverbial sand. Strangely, the charred remains of the gastronome's pets were surreptitiously gathered from the ashes and later sold to a European man, a German. And that is where the trail of this story goes cold. Chapter 2. If we should put a flame beneath where the story goes cold, warm the trail ever so slightly, our imaginations might turn to the gastronome's affair with the German woman, now disguised as an elderly man, as she makes her getaway by BMW motorcycle with the connoisseur's nose and throat. We might ask ourselves about that time in the gastronome's youth, when he and the German woman ate their way through Paris and then devoured each other, each imagining their favorite cream sauces, pâtés, and delightful fruit tarts as they heatedly explored the body electric. We'd certainly question whether the strange man who purchased the black remains of the parrot, the Dachshund, and the Rex might not be that former paramour in disguise once again. What might she hope to sift from the ashes of their past? His past, or hope to hold in her hands from the flames of their youth. Chapter 3. As the green Lamborghini sped through dark forests, his foot heavy upon the gas pedal, Anthony DiTillo delighted in skidding around curves, headlights flashing the eyes of red foxes, the occasional wild boar, and other creatures of the night. With the connoisseur's ample stomach contained in a huge rubber bladder in his trunk, which he always called the boot, having learned English from the Brits, Anthony DiTillo thrilled at his newly acquired illicit treasure. He sang and laughed to himself insanely at his good fortune. He felt like a player in the annals of history, or like a character in an updated version of the Thousand and One Nights. Within the stomach, in his race car's trunk, boot, he possessed that space where the most exquisite meals ever created were once digested. He imagined the ghosts of those meals still remained there as a kind of genie he might call upon for three wishes. So, mad with excitement, he skidded his green Lamborghini to a halt in the low autumn fog of the forest. He stepped out from his machine, popped open the boot, leaned in to unzip the rubber bladder to place his hands upon the connoisseur's stomach, closed his eyes, and made a wish. Chapter 4. Unsettling questions remained to be answered concerning where the gastronomist went with his bell jar containing the connoisseur's tongue. Who actually sold and who purchased the remains of the gastronome's pets? What really became of the German woman and the connoisseur's nose and throat? And what wish the Italian gentleman Anthony DiTillo intoned with his hands upon the connoisseur's stomach that night in the forest? Chapter 5. Too many answers can kill a story. And the truth is that I, though I am the only one who could know, have no final answers. I don't even know where this story came from or why I'm writing it. Maybe I was hungry when I started it, or maybe I'd lost my appetite for life altogether. Either circumstance seems plausible to me. Maybe I sought to make a profound comment about consumption, material wealth, and desire. Perhaps I could no longer live with the effete discriminations that pass for artful criticism that leads to an anal passion for collecting remnants of the past. Oh, I don't know if the morbid humor was my way of fending off my deep fears concerning our vulnerable, all-too-visceral mortality. Whatever the reasons, though, I do have my suspicions, my conjecture about a thing or two that I have reserved for the ending. To be quite honest, I'm hoping that by writing that I have reserved details for the ending, that something will come to mind to satisfy my hunger for closure here. Otherwise, I'll be left without consolation to huddle in a literary corner to lick my literary wounds, and that is an empty, soulless place. More so, I will have abandoned my responsibility to you, even though there is no you, as far as I know. Chapter 6. As Anthony DiTillo removed his suede driving gloves to place his hands upon the connoisseur's stomach, unbeknownst to him, a tremendous black bear had him in the crosshairs of its gaze. We will never know for sure what wish Mr. DiTillo intoned, for only incoherent growls and terrified screams resounded and echoed through the trees that foggy night. Unless he wished to be devoured by a black bear, we must assume that his wish did not come true. I, for one, do not believe that the German woman traveled to the United States to buy the charred remains of the gastronomist's pets. In my imagination, she was better than that. I imagine her sitting by a fire in her Tyrolean-style hunting lodge in the Black Forest, sitting there reading a leather-bound early edition of a collection of Grimm's tales, the connoisseur's nose and throat displayed prominently in a museum-quality, humidity-controlled cabinet behind her on the wall. Now and again, though, she might stare into the fire and remember a certain young man with whom she flung all caution to the wind, and at that moment she would recall the taste of a particularly rare cognac. now for what some of you will regard as a supreme disappointment, and what others will savor as a delicious mystery. The gastronome, a man of means, disappeared that night, carrying the connoisseur's tongue with him. In that version of the story, he retreats to Patagonia, where he oversees a sheep farm, grows a beard, and adopts the characteristics of his Welsh neighbors. The connoisseur's tongue is confined to a secret wall safe. He shows it to no one, and only dares to view it with the blinds drawn and doors locked. In an alternate take on the tale, the gastronomist doesn't make it out of the conflagration and is consumed in the flames along with his Rex, his Dachshund, and his Brazilian parrot. The connoisseur's tongue also goes up in flames, reminiscent of the closing scenes of a cheap horror film in which the House of Usher or House on Haunted Hill or some other unholy domicile meets its hellish end. These just desserts please people who believe that the universe is a fair and moral place. The final possibility, the one I currently believe, goes like this. The gastronome catches a lucky break and escapes the flames. He, his wife, and his two grown children, a young man and a young woman, each named after the above-mentioned German woman and Italian man, stand back behind a brave team of firemen who do their best to save the mansion, but fail. As the gastronomist clutches the bell jar containing the connoisseur's tongue, he feels the black tongue lapping at his conscience. He can stand no more. Though he considers throwing the jar to the ground, he cannot. When his wife and grown children ask what is wrong, he lies. He says, "I love you all more than anything in the world. You are all that matters." But of course, he feels his heart growing as black as the tongue in his arms, and he is haunted by the truth of his weakness, his everlasting desire to know what he will never know.
Thank you. One night, Vern and I were drinking wine and talking on the telephone. And he said he found some doobies in the stairwell. And Friar Tuck, the king of the zigzags, was bawling out the band. And in Lafayette's music room, there was no one in command. And Howard gave Vern a turn at the stern. And he did confirm that Friar Tuck was to adjourn back to the primordials. So Vern started mixing for the house and the radio stations.
You're listening to Maria Muldaur live from Lafayette, Fayette, Lafayette.
There seemed to be constant chaos
and temperamental bands.
Hey, dude, turn up the monitor.
Hey, man. I can't hear my guitar.
Hey, all I can hear are the fucking drums, man.
So life goes on, and Vern started losing his hair. And Howard moved up, and Vern moved in. And I got to sit in that chair. But I didn't have any hair to start with. Booking those first time William Morris acts. You'll find me upstairs in the old control room, picking out pounds of well-deserved earwax. Lafayette's Music Room is proud to present local records recording star
Maria.
Put your hands together, folks, for Mr. Pepsi
and Barry
the Cantaloupe.
Johnny the Ass
Rivers. And I carry an Uzi when I jump from the balcony.
And Blue Jets. And I love to jump on the trampoline while playing my guitar.
Niels Lofgren. And when I walk into the room, I'm expecting a double tall rum and coke.
Ramsey Lewis.
No, make that a case of Heineken.
Pure Prairie League.
A gallon of milk and a pink dressing room, or I'm not playing.
Glenda Rockstead.
And tonight we have two fifths of bourbon,
Jerry Jeff Walker. And tonight Lafayette's Music Room presents. 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 Tonight Lafayette's.
From Vern, Stephen and Kenny, happy holiday.
Word Jam.
19.